In the 1950s, Lincoln scholar David Donald published some essays, and one of them was called Getting Right with Lincoln, and it's about how all aspects of our society are trying to right themselves with Abraham Lincoln. In that essay, he mentions that as of 1939, when someone compiled a bibliography of works that had been written about Lincoln, there were over 1,000 pages. And, of course, if we take that from 1939 to now, of course, historians have lost count, but we could probably square that. Somewhere I read that more had been written about Abraham Lincoln than almost anything else. The Bible is an exception. Possibly Julius Caesar, but he's probably been surpassed by now. So quite extraordinary. Why is there so much to say about Lincoln? Well, there's lots of reasons. Because he stood firm when our nation was imperiled and prevented its destruction. North and South both have a lot to say about that. And you can imagine opinions differ widely on that. Was it his political acumen and dexterity, as Doris Kearns Goodwin writes in her book, The Team of Rivals? Was it his honesty? Now, there's a lot of myths about Lincoln that are not true. And there's a lot of those in the writings of William Herndon, his law partner, and, of course, Carl Sandburg. Of course, a lot of those things are true. In this case, from all that I know and from all that I have gleaned, he really was honest, unlike many others in his position. So that's one we can use as our model. Was it that he rose up from poor beginnings, from roots that were unappealing to him, among others, and to many? He wasn't the first president to do that, nor was he the last. And as a matter of fact, it's almost become necessary for everyone who runs for president to show how poor they really once were. Even including the Bushes, as well-connected and well-to-do as they are, you may remember that Bush the Elder had to eat pork rinds, and Bush the Younger had to clear brush, both in Texas. So there you have it. Was it Lincoln's spiritual balance and humility? As Ronald White writes in his book on Lincoln's second inaugural, was it his ability to grow on slavery, evolve on that issue over a period of time, as Eric Foner so well puts it in his recent book, The Fiery Trial? Was it his ability to see the big picture and separate that out from the details, as James McPherson comments in one of his books? Yes, it was all of those things. It's also his eloquence and his writing talents. If he were not president of the United States, he would stand just on the basis of his writings as one of the greatest members of the human race. His writings have been translated into innumerable languages all over the world. Well, to all of this, I would like to add something else. And this is not necessarily my own ideas. It's very hard for me to separate what my own ideas are anymore after reading about Lincoln and thinking about him. So this is not just me, but this is something I want to say. And that is that Lincoln had an ability to interpret our history in order to bring out what I see as the best in us as a people. As Vaclav Havel has said, nations are made up of great rememberings and great forgettings. By the way, I'd like to add, marriages are too, at last. I would say that Lincoln has interpreted our great rememberings in such a way as to shape our values as a people and to bring out, as Lincoln himself said in his first inaugural, the better angels of our nature. And so much of what Lincoln has reinterpreted for us has become a part of the fabric of our society and our own personal values, that it's very hard to know what was Lincoln's and what's ours. It's just become so much a part of who we are as Americans. And when you travel abroad, it becomes really clear to you that this is who you are. So today I'm going to look at how Lincoln interpreted the Declaration of Independence to express some of these values. And the centerpiece of this is the Declaration of Independence. One could talk for a lifetime about Lincoln's ideas. So I'm going to limit it to just a few in the Declaration of Independence. First, I want to just say a few words about the Declaration of Independence before Lincoln, as it was written by Thomas Jefferson and revised by the Committee of Five, of which he was one. And what I want to say about the Declaration of Independence as it was is that it was Anglo-centric. It had an English frame of reference. The people who were responsible for it were well aware of English history, English law, and English traditions. And they had that in their minds when they wrote it. One of the things that was foremost on their mind was the glorious revolution that had taken place in England almost 90 years before the Declaration was written. And what that did was to end divine right of kings in English history. The Glorious Revolution is the name given to the event where Parliament invited William of Orange and his wife Mary to leave Holland and come to England and reign as a constitutional limited monarchy. That was known also as a bloodless revolution, because there had been a number of revolutions before that in England, as well as regicides and political and religious strife, really, for centuries. And this was a way of saying, we're done with that, and we're going to live by rule of law, and strengthened Parliament at the expense of the king. Now, this was something that was written about by many people at the time, including John Locke. And one of the things that Locke said about this was that people had rights. People were born with rights. And that it was the job of the government to secure those rights, not to carry out the will of God, not to do anything else, but to secure those rights. And it was the right of the people to select their government. This may seem odd to say this about a king, but the fact is that in the context of its day, the idea that Parliament, speaking for the people of England, could invite a monarchy and depose another one peacefully, who, by the way, was the father of the new queen, but let's not get into that. Family conflicts, I guess we've all had them, but they really have plagued monarchies for a long time. Anyway, be that as it may, the idea that you have government by contract and that the government has a specific job to do, and that the people have a right to choose who that government is going to be. That idea came from England. And Locke put forward three basic rights that people had: life, liberty, and property. Now, the writers of the Declaration of Independence saw themselves essentially as Englishmen with the rights of Englishmen, but they saw that those rights, or believed that those rights, had been taken away from them by King George III, that he had abused them and abolished them. And what they were really striving for, in my opinion, was to restore those rights so they could live as free Englishmen. And you can actually look at the Declaration of Independence. I'll just look at one aspect of it. When they have these grievances, which is basically the lawyer's brief of the Declaration, just one of them I picked out. It says, they're indicting King George III for abolishing the free system of English laws. And this, I won't go into the whole thing where that was, but that, so that was something that resonated with them, that they were English and that they should enjoy English rights and that they didn't. Now, that being said, the fact is that they did say all men are created equal. They did not say all Englishmen are created equal. Now, why was that? Well, I don't really know why, except I have a couple of ideas. And one is that they wanted the help, and they knew they would need the help of other European states in order to defeat the British, because, by the way, they morphed into the British in the next century by the time of our revolution. So they knew they would need the help of other states to defeat the British, who had the greatest empire in the world at that time. And in fact, they did ask and got help from the French and the Dutch and the Spanish. So that wouldn't suit them to say, well, the rights of Englishmen, all Englishmen are created equal. Also, at the time, there was a great interest in science and what we call the Enlightenment and the idea of universal laws, of natural laws. And so, again, that would perforce cover everyone and not just the English. So because of these things, we have in the Declaration a universal statement. And it has been used ever since it was written by people all over the world in gaining their independence, realizing their human rights, and so on. Now, getting to Lincoln. So what about Lincoln and the Declaration of Independence? Well, it's interesting. If you read Lincoln's writings, you'll see that he refers to the Declaration far more than he does to the Constitution. Why is that? Well, I think it is because the Declaration of Independence really sets a standard, is a vision, is a principle, a promise, a hope, an ideal that we reach over time, and that, of course, we still haven't reached in its perfect form, or even in its not-so-perfect form. But in some form, we have tried to live that. Whereas the Constitution is an actual legal framework. It's a reality, and it's a practical reality. And you have to deal with it in terms of specifics. The Declaration is far more visionary. And what I'm going to argue is that Lincoln expands this hitherto Anglo-centric nature of the Declaration and makes it into kind of a national charter that suited his day and suits our day as well. It is the bedrock of our ideals as a nation. I want to look at three different ideas that Lincoln took and reinterpreted for us that are still so important to us. Someone else could pick out others There's a lot more, but I'm going to look at those three. The first one has to do with equality. Of course, those words of the Declaration are the most important words. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. That Lincoln expanded in a way that makes him seem very modern to us. And basically, I'm just going to read selections from his writing on these different points. So this first one is actually about July 4th, and it was written in 1858 and given right after the July 4th holiday. And he says, "Now it happens that we meet together once every year, sometimes about the 4th of July, for some reason or other. These 4th of July gatherings, I suppose, have their uses. If you will indulge me, I will state what I suppose some of them to be." And I'm just going to read little excerpts. He starts off by saying, "We are now a mighty nation. We are 30, or about 30 millions of people, and we own and inhabit about 1/15th part of the dry land of the whole earth. We run our memory back over the pages of history for about 82 years, and we discover that we were then a very small people in point of numbers, vastly inferior to what we are now, with a vastly less extent of country, with vastly less of everything we deem desirable." So then he says, who's responsible for this, for starting this process whereby we have become a much more powerful and well-to-do nation? And he says, "We find a race of men living in that day whom we claim as our fathers and grandfathers. They were iron men. They fought for the principle that they were contending for. And we understand that by what they did, it has followed that the degree of prosperity that we now enjoy has come to us. So we hold this celebration to honor these men." And of course, they are all men at that time that we're talking about. And that's all well and good, he says, and then I'll continue. "But after we have done all this, we have not yet reached the whole. There is something else connected with it. We have, besides these men, descended by blood from our ancestors, among us, perhaps half of our people who are not descendants at all of these men. They are men who have come from Europe, German, Irish, French, and Scandinavian, men that have come from Europe themselves or whose ancestors have come thither and settled here, finding themselves our equal in all things. If they look back through this history to trace their connection with those by blood, they find they have none. They cannot carry themselves back into that glorious epoch and make themselves feel that they are part of us. But when they look through that old Declaration of Independence, they find that those old men say that, quote, 'We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.' And then they feel that that moral sentiment taught in that day evidences their relationship to those men, that it is the father of all moral principles in them, and that they have a right to claim it as though they were blood of the blood and flesh of the flesh of the men who wrote that declaration. And so they are. This is the electric cord in that declaration that links the hearts of patriotic and liberty-loving men together, that will link those patriotic hearts as long as the love of freedom exists in the minds of men throughout the world." So this is, how modern can you get? Immigration. Of course, it's expanded from the Swedish and the Germans and the French to people everywhere. But the germ of it is right here in Lincoln in 1858. We are not a nation made up along tribal lines where we are all related by blood. We are related by our ideals. So I think that's something worth noting. A second important part of Lincoln's reinterpretation of the Declaration of Independence has to do with economic and social mobility. Now, in the Declaration, it says we have the right to life and liberty, what we got basically from Locke. But instead of property, we say the pursuit of happiness. Well, what does that mean? Well, it means the right to try your luck, to do what you can, to further your own mobility, your own happiness, your own interests, whatever. Well, Lincoln believed that it had to do with, and this is an idea that you see in Stephen B. Oates, among other people, that this happiness had to do with the right to rise. Remember that Lincoln himself came from very poor roots and was a very successful lawyer before he became president, and he had a fair amount of money, and he did rise, and he was in a society where it was possible for a person of ability to get ahead. And he wrote about this in many different ways, and one way I want to read to you, which is from his first debate with Douglas, which was also in 1858. And he wrote this about a month after the previous reading that I did. He says, and by the way, this is at Ottawa where this debate took place. He says, "There is no reason in the world why the Negro is not entitled to all the natural rights enumerated in the Declaration of Independence, the right of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I hold that he is as much entitled to these as the white man. I agree with Judge Douglas. He is not my equal in many respects, certainly not in color, perhaps not in moral or intellectual endowment. But in the right to eat the bread without the leave of anybody else, which his own hand earns, he is my equal and the equal of Judge Douglas and the equal of every living man." So in that one area at this time in 1858 of the right to earn and keep what you have earned by your own efforts, you are the equal of everyone. And even though to us today that might seem rather narrow, that he's saying that's the one right that you have, now we want other rights as well. But that was the thread that he was able to pull and that ultimately led him before his death to work so hard for the 13th Amendment, which those of you who have seen the movie Lincoln know what was going on in January and February of 1865, all the stops Lincoln needed to pull to get the Congress to pass that. So important was this idea to Lincoln that in his speech to Congress in 1861, which was in July, on July 4th, 1861, he talks about it again in terms of why the North is fighting. Why is the Union fighting? It's very easy to see why the South was fighting. And I won't get into that, but all right, so they wanted to leave the Union. So why didn't they just leave? Why did Northerners feel that they needed to fight in order to keep the South with them? So he defines what he sees as the essential nature of Northern society and of, therefore, the United States. He says, this is essentially a people's contest. On the side of the Union, it is a struggle for maintaining in the world that form and substance of government whose leading object is to elevate the condition of men, to lift artificial weights from all shoulders, to clear the paths of laudable pursuit for all, to afford all an unfettered start and a fair chance in the race of life. Yielding to partial and temporary departures from necessity, this is the leading object of the government for whose existence we contend. So for Lincoln, things like infrastructure that would level the playing field were very, very important. And in fact, when the South was out of the Union, the Congress passed the Land Grant College Act, the Homestead Act, and the funding for helping railroads to build the Transcontinental Railroad, all things that would just create wealth in the society. Finally, I want to say that Lincoln also was a nationalist. Now, that's, of course, the bottom line for why we fought to keep the South in the country. But as we saw before, he was not a nationalist along bloodlines, but he was a nationalist in the sense that he saw the promise of the United States as being a popular democracy that would be an example to the rest of the world and that would succeed as a popular democracy. And the very principle of democracy was imperiled, as he saw it, with the secession of the South. So from the very same speech, I'm going to read another paragraph. He says, our popular government has often been called an experiment. Two points in it our people have already settled, the successful establishing and the successful administering of it. One still remains, its successful maintenance against a formidable internal attempt to overthrow it. It is now for them to demonstrate to the world that those who can fairly carry an election can also suppress a rebellion, that ballots are the rightful and peaceful successors of bullets, and that when ballots have fairly and constitutionally decided, there can be no successful appeal back to bullets. That there can be no successful appeal except to ballots themselves at succeeding elections. Such will be a great lesson of peace, teaching men that what they cannot take by an election, neither can they take by a war, teaching all the folly of being the beginners of a war. So the very principle of democracy, in a sense, as promised in the Declaration of Independence, the right to choose government, and for that government to secure your rights, that was at the heart of Lincoln's nationalism. Now, was Lincoln original in all these ideas, the idea of equality, of mobility, of nationalism? No one is original in that respect. He very much expressed things that were going on at his time, ideals of people at his time. Nationalism, for instance, was widespread. You had the unification of Germany, of Italy, Pan-Slavism, just at about the same time. Was his emphasis on economics and economic mobility unique to him? No, it was not. I mean, Marx was writing it about this time. You have industrial revolutions going on. And, of course, the very idea of equality was something that was in the original Declaration of Independence. So it isn't so much that he was original. He might have been original in certain things. It was the way that he put it all together, the way he expressed it, his eloquence, and his standing for these principles in the face of this utter destruction. As you know, during the Civil War, we lost something like 620,000 people. And this is from someone who himself was not a warrior. He had a very undistinguished military record and was not really interested in military things, except to the extent that he had to be as commander-in-chief. Of course, how did he find out about what to do? Because he turned out to be quite a good military leader in the end. He read about it. They didn't have Twitter or Facebook or anything like that to email. He went and he read and he assimilated all this. But the fact is, he was not that interested in military things, and yet he presided over this total bloodbath out of a population of 33 million, losing 620,000, not to mention those who were injured. Okay, so now what does all this have to do with Unitarianism and with us here at this congregation? Well, it has a lot to do with it, and that's one of the many reasons I'm so glad to be here. We, too, are part of enlarging this circle of humanity. I look at our principles and see the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. The work that we've done with immigration, for instance, the Social Action Committee. We have been on the forefront of civil rights, gay rights, women's rights, rights for the disabled, rights for immigrants. And the circle keeps growing. And we have the opportunity here to participate in that, to expand that, and to keep it alive, and to keep the promise of the Declaration alive. We are, as it says in the hymn for today, we are building a land together. So thank you. I think that's true. I think certainly if you look back at Jefferson's time and you look at Lincoln's time, Native Americans were really low on the totem pole, so to speak. And in fact, my husband, Will, did a paper when he was at Columbia on, at the end of the Civil War, the tribes that sided with the Confederacy actually did better with the government, the national government, than did the ones that sided with the Union. So it's like, no matter how you look at it, they were shafted. At the same time, I think that has changed. And I would argue that the seeds of that are in the Declaration of Independence. You know, in the part that, the opening words that Jennifer gave us about there's a lot of evil in the world, but it doesn't prevail. The idea that extending that to people who were considered savages, if you read the Declaration of Independence, they're called savages. You'll find that in the Declaration, to the point where we have some appreciation today of the contribution that Native Americans have made, not only to our ideas of ecology, but to our ideas of democracy, because they had practicing democracies within their tribes, within the limits they did. So I would just say, yes, and they were excluded. They were not seen as humans. At that time, in the 19th century and before, that is changing. And I think one could argue all men are created equal would include women and would include Native Americans. So, thank you. Any other? Well, what I would say is that it's the process that it takes a long time. I'm thinking about something that friends of mine who were from the Soviet Union said as a kind of joke, but they said, you know, no people, no problems. The problem is we have people. and they don't all agree. And we're trying to do this messy thing that's a democracy. And, you know, last week when we had talking about gay rights and gay marriage and very celebratory, and yet at the same time we have that decision about voting rights. It's like, what country are we in anyway, you know? And it's all of the above. And I guess what gives me strength from reading Lincoln, because believe me, I have my very dark days, very dark about this country, is that despite it all, to have this hope and to have this sense of promise and to keep going is all that we can do. But it's there. The thread is there if we choose to pick it up and just pull on it. It's not going to be easy. Well, that is true that he, as far as we know, did not attend church. But he was, I think, a very religious man. He was not a church-going man. I think that he had a real sense of God's will acting out in history. I think that if you read his writings, his spiritual balance is truly astounding. But I don't think it was attached to any one specific dogma or religious group. And I think that's true. And maybe that gave him a little bit more tolerance of other people, of people who were not themselves churchgoers or were perhaps very intolerant people. And he had a great deal of sympathy for Southerners, for instance, of course, and he was himself born in Kentucky, and his wife was as well. And so, yes, what you say is true, but I don't think it was totally a facade. I mean, he was, as we all know, self-educated, and he read the Bible, and that's where a lot of his language comes from. So I would say, yes, he was not formally a religious man, but I'd say in a deep spiritual way he was. And even though certain things were manipulated, I don't think that was one of them.